It's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Oh, it's a goal. Who got the assist?
Hello. So with just 2 weeks to go ahead of the new season, we're back recording again, you know, like normal, following a brilliant intermission, which was the summer specials. We really hope you enjoyed those summer specials, which were on behavioral science, fandom, analytics in terms of their interaction with FPL. They were an absolute pleasure to record, but, you know, they were done back in June. Like literally the Euros have been and gone since we recorded them. So we've not really done anything, you know, live as it were for a whole month now, meaning we're eagerly getting ourselves back in gear from now on ahead of the new season. Basically it's normal service from here. We are Who Got the Assist. You can find me on Twitter at WGTA_FPL. My Irish friend Anthony here at FPL Stag, also on Instagram, WGTA.FPL. Make sure you give us a follow on those channels if you don't already, and subscribe to our podcast wherever you get it. The other thing, please, if you haven't got around to it yet and you've enjoyed anything we've done over the last 5 years, give us a 5-star review wherever you listen to us, as they're greatly appreciated in terms of spreading the word of the pod. The league code is 2IP43T. There's no jingle we can make around that. Just try to remember it and find it. It's on my bio, I think, on Twitter. And we're also on video for the first time solidly now. I did not get the quick PowerPoint, which you guys can see here if you are watching. But it's meant to be a visual support rather than the star of the show, as it were. We don't have the time or resources as amateur podcasters in full-time employment to put together a proper, you know, edited, spankly take. I'd really love to, but I can't at the moment. So this more rustic look is what we're going to go for. It's always going to be audio first. Head over to our YouTube if you prefer to watch rather than listen to us for whatever reason. But, you know, we are always going to kind of look at it audio first. But if you do watch, you may kind of see, hear some things which don't make it into the edit, and you can maybe kind of understand a bit better the magic of editing that I tried to put through. Anyway, it's been a month, Anthony, even though to listeners, because they had all the summer specials, it kind of felt like we were with them every week. It's been a month since we've spoken like this. You all right? Did you enjoy the Euros?
Yeah, Tom, I absolutely love the Euros. It's actually incredible how much time feels like it has passed since those Euros at this point. Like, it's only a handful of weeks, but those Euros were amazing. They had everything. Good goals, great matches, probably the best night of football that I would ever remember anyway, the Croatia-Spain and France-Switzerland night. A night that we were trying to record a podcast.
That was a terrible idea, wasn't it?
Yeah, a podcast which I was recording, but I was really in truth just focusing on the France-Switzerland game on my phone for the whole entire thing. Yeah,
I think this kind of format of us being on video would not have worked for that.
No.
Because it was just like, right, hang on, guys. hang on, turn the shoot out now. All right.
Incredible. And look, and in the end, Italy were a great team to watch. They use a really interesting system that relied on so much movement and tactical intelligence. And I thought they were deserving winners of the tournament all in because of that. And so, you know, it was just a good tournament all in all. This podcast, of course, we're bringing us back to FPL, so might as well get to it. We're going to be looking at doing our full pricing analysis. We're going to do this as well as we can in a reasonable length of time. What we're not doing in order to do that is going club by club, running through player by player. More power to those that do that, we've done it in previous years and found it unwieldy. So we're going to try a different tack. So what we're trying to do instead is focus on the key areas that UFPL managers are going to be wrestling with. How we're going to do that? We're going to look at FPL through the lens of the Twitter template. It's a good proxy for seeing what engaged managers are doing at the moment, and it dodges an awful lot of the fandom and recency bias that tends to drive game week one ownership overall. That said, please do be aware that we have to factor in herd mentality that exists on FPL Twitter. We will do our best to unpick that as we go through, but it is always worth keeping in mind why there are certain players in the template and maybe if the herd is picking them for another reason.
Absolutely. A quick health warning. Things are moving very, very fast at the moment. Only this morning, we had to kind of just say, oh, no, Harry Kane's not showing up to training. And maybe that in itself dates this pod. We recorded on Monday, the 2nd of August in the evening. Please forgive anything we say which may rankle with the truth as you know it. And we're hoping that nothing happens tomorrow, which is seismic to blow everything out of the water. But that is kind of, you know, the situation we're in at the moment and why we left the pricing pod till now. Because at the end of the day, as we said, I think back in June when we initially recorded our kind of first kind of reaction to the season, well, if we'd recorded something back then, it would have all been like, well, we don't know. Oh, maybe this could happen. At least we've got some element of certainty now. Obviously, it's not 100%, but it's a much higher percent of fidelity than it was beforehand.
Even that June podcast, poor Tom had to go back and edit so many times to fix up things to do with like the Daka move and the Sancho move. And oh, it was a day by day that pod was being dated. We tried to record it. I think it was 8 days before we were releasing it. Every day there was another issue that Tom had to go and deal with.
So as Anthony mentioned, the main way we're going to be doing this podcast is pivot off the current Twemplate. The Twemplate is, of course, a portmanteau of Twitter and template. Don't like portmanteaus, you're listening to the wrong podcast, to be honest. And for those who don't know what the template is, that's basically the herd choice, as Anthony kind of mentioned earlier on. If you had to take the most vanilla, you know, bland team that exists out there, that's the template, effectively. And Twitterville, as Anthony also alluded to, can change the template a little bit. Certain differences do exist between the real world, as it were, and the Twitter world, and we'll call them out during this. Anyway, our mate James Quarrell at FPLJQ, he's coming on the pod actually in game week 3, suggested this team. I put it on Twitter and people mostly agree with it. I think the only change I actually have made is Antonio has come in for DCL. But basically the team is, in goal, you've got Sanchez and Foster. The back five is Alexander-Arnold, Dean, Shaw, Fofana and Ayling. Midfield, Salah, Bruno, Rafinha, Buendia, Brownhill, and up front, Watkins, Antonio, and Tony. Obviously, things may have changed again. I think I asked people about this 2 days ago, but you know, Ben White may be potentially an entrant now, Brandon Williams at 4.0. I mean, this is the team we'll be using, basically, the one I've just described. And as Anthony says, kind of that forms a template to our podcast as well. A sense of beautiful symmetry I actually quite like. And we'll be referring to it from now on just to keep you kind of updated to make sure everyone's on the same page. Obviously, it could all change tomorrow. And definitely will after the Community Shield next week, when we'll be throwing at everyone to get whoever does goals in that in. But yeah, that's how we're structuring it. We're going to mess the order up a little bit as well. So we're going to do midfielders, goalkeepers, defenders, and strikers. We're going to look at three tiers per position. So premium, support, and fringes. Pretty self-explanatory, I'm sure. But support kind of means, you know, mid-price. Fringes means low price. I'm just trying to save us a couple of syllables, basically. And obvious caveats, whistle stop is an understatement. As Anthony said, there's no way we're going to be able to cover everyone and all ownership data is correct at the time of recording. So Anthony, one thing before we kind of jump into it, do you think that the template has formed quicker than normal this year?
I don't necessarily think it's about that it's formed quicker than normal. I think it's more it has formed further off the start of the season than it has in previous years. And I think so much of that was down to the fact that the game was released so early in June. It really took us all by surprise when it was released. And so just engaged managers have been tinkering from very early on. That meant that the ownerships were already there. That meant that when the less engaged managers came in and started making FPL teams in July and into August, they saw who was popular and they started putting them into their teams. And so I think there was a self-fulfilling prophecy there.
The herd mentality got involved, didn't it?
Yes, the herd starts to really push towards this type of team. So I think for a variety of reasons, this team has come together. This team has cemented further from game week one than previous seasons. That said, as you kind of have already alluded to, Tom, I would expect so many changes between now and the first game of the season on August 13th. We've got so many preseason friendlies. It's nice to see actually Premier League teams playing against each other instead of touring. I think it helps us with a view to trying to figure out who is going to be in teams. COVID is still causing problems. Injuries are going to be inevitable. Transfer window is obviously still open. We have the Super Cup coming up with Chelsea featuring in that against Villarreal, and of course Community Shield with both City and Leicester that you mentioned. So between all of those different things, there's going to be so much moving around. But at the same time, there is a template or a template that is very much formed at this point.
Yeah, certainly. Maybe there's a few kind of scrabbles around the edges as well with, you know, what you said about injuries. For example, Lamptey was one of those players who was in a lot of teams and maybe would have gotten a lot of airtime in this podcast. But obviously, since we did the first podcast, Graham Potter's come out and said he's not going to be quite ready for game week one. So he's swiftly exited the template. Right, let's move on to the very beginning, which is the midfield. So the template midfield is Salah, Bruno, Rafinha, Buendia and Brownhill. To start off with the premiums, as you might expect, the template has Mo Salah, who's 49% owned at the moment, and Bruno 41% owned. Quickly, would you overthink Salah?
I've tried it in previous years and it hasn't worked out. And maybe last year I was burnt for being too loyal. But even in a bad year, he was the third top scorer in FPL and he had 22 goals and 6 assists. He was the only player last season who had an XG of over 20. And only him and Kane had an XG of over 10 in the second half of the season. With an opening fixture against Norwich, and then he has Burnley with his ownership near 50%, with a fair few good fixtures in there as well, I can't build a compelling case not to put him in my side. I think it would be Harry Carey to not put him in.
I think we've gone to that point, haven't we? You know, 4 200 club finishes, 1 400 club finish, of course, that first season, where you're kind of like, well, what more has he got to do if you aren't including this guy in your team? Like, he's more than worth the price tag. Of course, you know, last year was his lowest points total ever, I think, in FPL. But as you said, the data speaks for itself. And, you know, I could reel off similar data. There's no point in really going there. The other one, though, is obviously Bruno. And the question that could be asked and has been asked and since Sancho has joined, certainly has begun to become debated a little bit on socials, is do we dare step beyond Bruno Fernandes? The usual arguments are out, aren't they? But am I not captain him if I own him? I mean, he's got Leeds, Southampton, Wolves and Newcastle in the first four. I mean, with Bruno, as I mentioned during Talisman Theory, it's almost become implicit, I think, Anthony, just how good Bruno was last season. You know, in the midst of hindsight, we kind of forget that it was his first season in the Premier League. And United haven't had a main man like him for quite a long time. He had the most chances created of any player last season, joint most big chances created with Kevin De Bruyne. KDB had a lot of injuries, so that's just how bloody good he is, basically. And he had the highest XA. Couple that with him being fifth for XG, and he's pretty compelling. And one thing, though, is that Bruno's non-penalty XG is pretty meh for a premium. So he goes from being fifth for XG with 17.64 to 17th in the non-pen XG rankings, which is just 10. So in terms of non-pen XG last year, he was outscored by the likes of Shea Adams, Timo Werner and Bobby Firmino in that regard. You know, 10 penalties from him last year, 9 scored. So that means half of his goal outputs was therefore from the spot. But even if you expunge pens for some weird reason, you've still got 9 goals, 14 assists. He's a creator, but a creator with an eye for goal, basically. He's Kevin De Bruyne. And I know there was some penalty mania last year. We mentioned that a lot. 9 penalties that year. But the last couple of years, United have also been top and second for penalties won. So year before that, Rashford scored the most penalties of 6. Year before that, Pogba was second for 7 penalties. I think writing them off is a little bit of kind of artificial sort of thinking.
I totally agree. United are usually in with near double figures or double figures for penalties, and penalty mania didn't change that. You know, you've cited penalties scored. If you just cite, you know, United were missing penalties before Bruno came in, and of course when Rashford was the highest scoring in penalties, it's like Bruno had taken over penalties for half of that season as well, and, you know, contributes to them as well. So they're double figures-ish for penalties. You can't write them off with United. It's a little bit lazy. I think with Bruno, it is tempting to exclude him from your side. But I think, again, a bit like Salah, it would be an overcomplication to do so. And like, yes, okay, the end of the season was disappointing with him. Even just looking at Bruno's basic stats, his XG and his XA dropped off in the final 10 games of the season. So usually he was getting an XG of 0.42. That dropped off marginally, I suppose, to 0.37. His XA had been at 0.3. That dropped off to 0.22. But maybe in points per game, it's where his decline, I guess, was most marked. He'd been getting 6.59 points per game across the whole season. And yet in those final 10 games of the season, it was just 4.38, nearly a return per game is what's that expecting, you know? So it's still saying that he was a decent enough asset, although maybe not worth a premium price. The thing is that Bruno is the type of player who outperforms his stats. He's had a decent enough rest. The Euros is quite a bit ago for him since Portugal knocked out.
Yeah.
And he didn't even play all that much at that Euros. So I'd be pretty optimistic for him and I wouldn't overthink it.
Well, certainly. So it sounds like we kind of agree broadly. It sounds like there's not really a question this year about Mane, for example. I mean, serious cold streak last season. I think that he's probably just one. He's kind of a bit of a marginal pick. I mean, we're going to speak about triple Liverpool later on. And he's not one who was really in the equation. It was about more about Robertson than Jota. But Bruno, alternatives-wise, I think it might be interesting just to meditate for a second. As you mentioned at the end of last season, obviously, Bruno did slow down. One man did step in then was Mason Greenwood. In the exit velocity on my Talisman Theory piece, which is worth reading if you can find it elsewhere, just go on whogotassist.com, it's right in front of you. He basically kind of took that mantle over the course of the kind of last 10 games, which he scored the most points of any United player in terms of attacking points. He's actually had an increasing number of minutes per season between last year and this year. And he's had this change in profile as well, which is really interesting as well. So 2019-20, he scored 10 goals from an XG of about 3. He massively overshot. And there was that period in Project Restart when he made a mockery of that 4.5 million price tag. Last year, though, it was a different story. So an XG of 7, 7 goals scored. And his XG per 90 rose, as did his shots per 90. FPL-wise, though, similar totals, 103 to 106. But maybe because he's becoming a bit more settled in the team, maybe he could be the one to look at, especially with Rashford out. But I guess Sancho's the big one, though, Anthony, that people are kind of thinking, oh, you know, I'm going to give him a go. He could be, you know, the new Salah, do not draws. 83 goal involvements, 104 appearances for Borussia Dortmund. I think he played 83 90-minute games in the time he was actually on the pitch. But it's basically one goal involvement per 90 for Borussia Dortmund over the last 4 years, which is ridiculous if that's translated into the Premier League. And think about the Euros, you know, the likes of Honigstein were dismayed that England weren't playing this guy. So he perhaps, if he does hit the ground running, could be one with that ridiculous goal involvement at Dortmund. If he can translate into playing in red, he could be, you know, a solution if you aren't looking at Bruno and you're thinking of moving elsewhere. I mean, as United fan, you said a minute ago you're not looking elsewhere, but could either of them kind of come to the fore? Or can you understand why either of them could be in a team?
I can definitely understand why people are going for Sanchez. I guess the issue with Greenwood is still that you're just not 100% sure that he's going to get the minutes that you require. You're a bit more sure of it all when Rashford is injured. But at the same time, just I feel like Solskjaer has quite a few players to, you know, address in there. We don't know how Sancho is going to take up, you know, attacking space that might otherwise have been Greenwood's. You'd presume Cavani is going to be in there in the mixture as well. And then there's obviously some of the supporting cast players, the likes of Daniel James, who might get a run. And so with that in mind, that's why I'm a little bit off Greenwood. I think it's just too big of a risk. On the other hand, I feel and I can understand why people would go for Sancho. 9.5 is incredibly cheap given his track record coming into the league. And I guess given the team that he's coming into isn't exactly a bad one. If anything, it's, you know, one that's kind of on the up year on year for 2-3 seasons. The thing as well, I guess, is that at 9.5, is he a 200 club player? I think he might be, potentially.
They've got the potential to get there, hasn't he?
Absolutely, absolutely. And it kind of feels a little bit reminiscent of Son last year when he was so underpriced and it was like, okay, there's an element of a no-brainer to put him into your side. I still didn't because, you know, I'm not a genius.
Yeah,
but, you know, but someone like Nick did, you know, just totally identified 200 club player there, price quite cheap, put him in, easy, you know, get points. And I do feel like there is that with Sancho. I wish actually United were playing in the European Super Cup and had beaten Villarreal just so that we had a chance to see how United were going to line out with their first team in a competitive game before the start of this season. It's so unfortunate that we don't have that to just get some idea of what they're going to do. Yeah, if you weren't going with Bruno, I would say it would have to be Sancho, but you're really taking a massive risk. I'm maybe a little bit too conservative to do that.
I agree. I'm the same. I think it's easier to work downwards than try to work upwards. That's the way I look at it. You mentioned Son there quickly, worth kind of just squeezing a mention of him in, because in the Talisman Theory, I did mention that he was actually fifth for attacking points last year, and he got really unlucky because of how good Kane was. Obviously, Kane has not showed up to training today, whereas Son has got a new contract, and it remains to be seen what happens here. But I imagine once game week 3 rolls around and they've got Watford at home, loads of people are going to be looking to go into Son. So loads of people are kind of saying, oh, you know, Kane's a talisman, Son could be an absolute pile of, you know, without Kane. The reality is, though, that in the past, I remember whenever Kane was injured, Son became a really obvious pickup. And there's really good research done by Chimp Paradox on Twitter, who showed that actually Son's goals per game, XG per game, shots per game, shots on target per game, shots in his box per game, and big chances per game went up without Harry Kane in the team. So there's definitely kind of green shoots of recovery without Kane being around for Son, depending on how Nuno sets him up, of course. But obviously, it's one that's clearly firmly in the wait and see mold. But you know, at 10 million, he could be one that is on our shortlists. And you know, come game week three, there's a game which presents itself. One other thing in this area, Kevin De Bruyne, maybe worth just kind of getting rid of City here, actually, Anthony, so don't weigh us down throughout the course of this podcast. Yeah. Kevin De Bruyne, owned by 15% of people, non-talismanic team last year, but in terms of attack points scored, five City players in Gundogan, Foden, Mahrez, KDB and Sterling, maybe top 20, and maybe value in defence, of course, Diaz, we'll speak about him later. But City last year in FPL was all about timing. Getting people like Gundogan onto that defence in terms of goal machine stones. It was about kind of getting them when they were hot. You know, you snooze, you lose. In terms of the midfield and the team as a whole, it was telling that pre-season, before he transferred out to Leeds, Jack Harrison was Man City's highest scoring player in FPL. He'd actually scored 3 more points than Gundogan last season, 160. Safe to say Gundogan, 7.5, yeah, surprised us last season, but he needs Kevin De Bruyne to be out. And Kevin De Bruyne as well, you know, people are saying, well, game week two, Norwich, I'm sure people are going to go absolutely mad for that. Maybe he could be the, you know, the Bruno switch. But I think there is one guy who's kind of showing up a little bit, and that's Riyad Mahrez. Lots of love for him at nine. He's obviously been a bit of a kind of per 90 king, maybe getting a new contract at City. He played his most minutes for Man City last season ever, basically. 21 games worth, so nothing. 145 points, less good than last season. And he's a bit of a kind of a Jota-esque per 90 monster, as I said. And it's all about whether he could kind of nail that persistent start. But with Mahrez, what's really interesting is that he's had a full pre-season, unlike the likes of Sterling, Foden, and the Community Shield we've mentioned a couple of times, 4.9% owned. If he does something in that game, Anthony, he could be one of the people who makes a late charge for the Swen play, don't you think?
Yeah, I think that's really cogent, actually, with when it comes to Mahrez. I had seen him starting to crop up in a few teams on Twitter, yet not enough for him to knock into this Swen play yet, but he is starting to appear already. So as you say, I think, yeah, he is primed to find his way into this. And there are good reasons to put him in, but it's just timing that makes it just so hard to know what to do with him. You know, it's like you could argue as well that if City don't sign a striker, i.e. Harry Kane, in the lead up to game week one, is someone like
Ferran Torres.
Yeah, this is it. Like, is Ferran Torres going to find his way in? Or would it just be Jesus? Like, there's a move away for Jesus being mooted if you listen to Sam Lee in The Athletic. But you'd imagine that's quite contingent on whether Kane goes in the first place. And then, of course, there's Sterling, who we might as well toss into this as well. Absolutely. Which Sterling is going to show up in the league this year? He is really well priced, I think, to force a decision at 11.0 in a way that Sadio Mane at 12 is not. He had three consecutive 200 club finishes before the 154 points that he got last season. He had a good Euros from a perspective of goal scoring confidence. I would be really, really interested to see, you know, if he has a good Community Shield, he's going to rocket into that Twem plate as well. I really feel like last season was a real aberration for him. And that's a City team that just, you know, produces as a system to feed its players. And for whatever reason last year, it just did not work for him. But I don't think that's going to happen 2 years in a row. He's too good of a talent for them to waste.
Maybe. I'm not sure he'll rocket into the team. Maybe you'll see some people reacting to that, but I still think that, as you said earlier,
Think of Aubameyang's brace in the Community Shield last year.
That was because of talisman theory, Anthony. That was not because of Aubameyang's brace. That was because of my amazing writers. No, I'm not that kind of guy. But yeah, no, I take your point. I think that makes a lot of sense. All right, let's move forward in the interest of brevity and move to the support. Which we have given a very, very large kind of price bracket area to 9.0 to 5.5. Maybe we're going to try to kind of cut this up a tiny bit. You know, the Twem plate has got two players, Rafinha at 23% and Buendia at 12%. One of those players who doesn't quite kind of feature outside of Twitter. So Grealish, 35% ownership, and Mount nearing 21% ownership. Outside the premiums, these kind of options, I've called them support options because they're very unlikely to be your captain a lot of the time. You're counting on their sort of, you know, their raw points week to week. But, you know, we should have a look and try to identify our favourite assets around this because, you know, Rafinha and Buendia, there's quite a gap between them and the two premiums that we've got here. I just want to kind of bring in one man here, Kai Havertz. So I owned him actually last year, game week one. And for me, I think the appeal was fairly clear for game one this year with Crystal Palace, who were obviously in transition first up. Last year, obviously, didn't set the world alight. 91 points in FPL for a huge £72 million signing. But I think Lampard just basically didn't know how to use him effectively. He was thrown out onto the wing, not really involved. And this is shown in his output. One goal and two assists before Frank departed in game week 18, I think it was. Also COVID. Compare that with Tuchel coming in game week 20 onwards, and it's really fascinating the difference. I mean, admittedly, it's not brilliant, but 0.4 shots on target per game under Frank to 1.3 shots on target per game under Tuchel, 0.5 shots in the box per game under Frank to 2.37 under Tuchel, 0.13 XG per game to 0.54 XG per game under Tuchel. And over the last 10 game weeks, his MPXG shot through the roof comparatively, actually. He averaged 0.8 XG per game over the last 10 game weeks. So it just shows that Tuchel knows how to use him. And, you know, some people could say, you know, I'm going to leave him for now. Game week 7, the fixtures are going to turn over. But 8.5 million, he's one of those players who kind of, again, undercuts that. I'm not saying he's going to be a 200-point player. I think he's still kind of got a little way to go. He's still a young man. But at the same time, you're looking at probably a player who could get 160, 170 points there. And, you know, Chelsea have had a couple of years in the wilderness when it comes to talisman, when it comes to kind of FPL, you know, been looking at the defence a lot. They haven't really had that kind of player going forward. You want to be including, we all thought that'd be Werner. And I think Kai could be that guy, you know, the heir to the kind of Hazard talisman mantle. So, you know, I'm, again, quite high on him this year. And he is actually in my team. We'll kind of look at that at the very end of this podcast. But I think he might actually be quite useful as well, because he occupies that kind of spot between the premiums and kind of the support that is currently there. It feels like with the 6.5, you've got a bit of an issue if someone in the middle kind of takes off. And I think Kai kind of nicely does that. I know he's got Arsenal game week two and so on and so forth. But equally, you know, I'm not too worried about playing a player from a top team in that kind of game. Anthony, you mentioned that you looked at Grealish as well, and he's one of those players who, you know, he's owned by 35%. Obviously, his future's up in the air, isn't it?
Yes, this is the thing with Grealish. At Man City, you can just, you know, add him to the little bit of a discussion we just had and the uncertainty that we were kind of attaching to an awful lot of their midfielders. Him at Villa, I really, really like, and I think he is actually a potential 200 club player there as a talisman at that club. In terms of points per game last season, we had 5.19 points per game. If you multiply that average by 38 for the full season, that's 197. So he was on the cusp of a 200-point season in points per game metrics, at least, in the bit that we did see of him last season. So that's pretty impressive in and of itself. He still had 12 assists. That was second for mids and fourth in total. And he missed nearly half the season. And Villa, of course, have good starting fixtures. The problem is, of course, is that he might not get those fixtures. And so what I've also done is I've looked at the two, I think, marquee Villa midfielders when it comes to, you know, let's say goals, because Buendia is more of a provider. How they did last season in that Villa team when Grealish was injured. And those two are Anwar El Ghazi and Bertrand Traore. Look at stuff like shots in the box and things. Traore, it's 1.67. That's much more than the 0.94 per game that El Ghazi was recording. Traore as well is well ahead in terms of assists and expected assists and attempted assists. And so with that in mind, I think that Traore kind of has that potential to be add a few more goals to his game and suddenly end up as a much better option than El Ghazi. And I think he has the underlying stats there to do that. So that's kind of the reason why I think overall, I think Traore has the higher ceiling there. So yeah, there's some pretty good options there in that Villa midfield all told. And Buendia is obviously the one that is in the template from there, but he's in on the basis of basically what he did for Norwich, which was just create an awful lot of chances that weren't finished.
Don't forget, though, he assisted Watkins in pre-season. That's probably the compounding bit of evidence which has got him into the template here.
I think back to our summer special, Tom, where the lads were saying that it takes about 20 games for them to start to take into account statistics, and then the template has gone mad on one assist,
he's got an assist, one preseason game.
Well,
he's straight in for me. You're right on Buendia. You know, fourth for chances created since 2019-20. He was second behind Kevin De Bruyne for chances created per 90, but he failed to hit 100 points that season. One goal, seven assists. Last season, though, the Championship, very encouraging, 15 goals and 17 assists. And it was noted, actually, on Who Scored, that Buendia, when he was in the Premier League, he dropped off in terms of key passes per game and shots per game, for Norwich, that is. So maybe he may be better in a better team. And you're right, like, you know, maybe Villa in general in the midfield could be a good punt for those first three games. But is he in my team? I'm not yet sure. I've got a penchant for Buendia from the past when he was at Norwich, but he never seemed to quite be able to replicate it in terms of kind of consistent point scoring. I do think, you know, we've moved from Grealish down to Buendia, and there are a few players who are in the middle, you know, likes of Mason Mount, and it basically the most vanilla player you can probably get. But in terms of those vanilla metrics, like shots, chances created, he's actually top of those for anybody 7.5 million or below. Madison Barnes, they could come out in the Community Shield. Pepe as well, quick shout out for him. Last 10 game weeks of the season, he scored the third most points for mids under 7.5 and the most points of any Arsenal player, actually. 57 points, 23 points clear of the person who was second, who was Callum Chambers, Suge's man, an FPL. But there's one guy that's worth mentioning here before we kind of get into the 6.5 million kind of maelstrom, Diogo Jota. So I think that he's one, obviously, with Firmino perhaps coming back a little bit late. Who is going to be in the mix, being out early of the Euros. A bit of an arc points dodger. But last season, fun fact, he had the highest XG per 90 and shots in the box per 90 of any player in FPL. He had the better ratio of that than Salah, Vardy, Ike, Nacho, etc., etc. But if you stretch that out, you've got an XG of 8-ish, 9 goals scored. Like, with him, you've got a player who's ludicrously effective if he does play, but equally incredibly frustrating as well. And I know we learned on the analytics pod, you mentioned that a second ago, but it's that the player's had a big chance, not that he's missed it and frustrated you. But he is certainly a player who I think, similar to Mane actually, needs kind of variance, luck, form, whatever you call it, to go his way. Otherwise, he's likely to be, you know, first subbed and he's not likely to start the next game. But he could be an example of a player in that sort of 7.5 sort of area. That means that, you know, at the moment, the Twem plate, you have kind of this huge drop between Bruno at 12 and a 6.5 in Rafinha and Buendia. So he could be a kind of an example of a player. He could occupy a bit of middle ground to allow you to kind of move around this sort of area. But, you know, I appreciate why players like Buendia and Rafinha are kind of in the team. I mean, Rafinha, Anthony, is he somebody that you've looked at?
Rafinha is a tempting one. But I think maybe this is maybe me being someone who kind of reacts to herd mentality by trying to push away from it. He's not currently in my side. The thing with him, like, and of course, his ex-lively is off the charts. Like, to watch him is an absolute joy.
And
last season, like, he was very good. Like, he you know, there were points in the season where he was more than pulling his weight. He got to double figures for assists with 10, obviously got 6 goals as well. And you kind of felt like, you know, his early, you know, he obviously wasn't in that Leeds team to start. The further he grew into the season, the more you felt like he was an important player in that team. And the more you felt that he was an important player in FPL. And so with that in mind, 6.5 could be made a complete mockery of. At the same time, just because Leeds are opening fixtures are just that little bit more awkward, I'm quite happy to go without him to start and kind of maybe put my money elsewhere. The player actually that sticks out to me of that 7.5 procession, and I know that Rafinha is a little bit below that, is Pepe, just because of how he ended last season. I suspect that Arteta can't ignore that. Brentford away, obviously being the opening game of the season. There's an awkward 2 games with Chelsea and City, but then you've got Norwich and Burnley as well. That could be pretty interesting. I feel like all of those players, too, in one way or another, are going to be a punt. With Jota, and we're going to get onto it later, the punt there is that you're not going for another type of Liverpool triple up if you put him into your side. And that's kind of the reason why I'm not too keen on him, because I want to triple up in a different way to one which includes him. And then with Rafinha, it is just those fixtures. I suspect I'm going to probably early wildcard. That's my kind of mental plan at the moment. And I would be very surprised if he doesn't come into my side, because he probably offers better value than Bamford, who, of course, we'll get onto in the forwards at 8.0. Yeah.
I think Rafinha definitely is that ex-lively factor, which is why he's in. He's many a manager's kind of anointed glue guy for the season, which I can get, actually. So 6 goals, 10 assists last season, 133 points. An okay start for the Premier League. As you said, it was a bit stop-start. And he was outscored by Harrison on the opposite flank on 160. Data-wise, though, Rafinha outstrips Harrison on pretty much every measure. XG, XA, you know, per game shots, per game, whatever. And the only real pro in Harrison's column actually is big chances. So Harrison got 90 and on to Rafinha's 5. And Harrison actually appeared in all 38 games for Leeds last season, with 36 starts, 2 subs. And Rafinha actually just 30 and 4 subs. And similar to the exercise you did earlier on with a couple of other players, I worked out Rafinha's points per 90 and extrapolated for 38 games just for fun. So he played 26 games worth of minutes last year for his 133 points, which gives you like 5.1 points per game. Multiply that by 38. You get 193 points. Obviously, that's incredibly crude. That's ridiculous. But it's an indication of what he has in him to do at that price, perhaps kind of alluding to what you said earlier on. You can make a mockery of that kind of price tag. And my observation, perhaps, is where Harrison hit his ceiling with the 160, Rafinha certainly didn't. So where Harrison may be slightly underpriced, Rafinha also might be underpriced, but maybe making the comparison between two of them isn't particularly useful. And the eye test as well, definitely, as we've said a few times, ex-Lively will definitely tell you that. Again, same with me. In my team at the moment, no, he's not, because I've got Shaw and Dean, and he plays both of them in the first 2 weeks of the season. So do I want one of my key midfielders playing one of my 5.5 million defenders the first weeks of the season? No, I don't. So he's not there right now. And I agree with you that an early wild card, he could very well find his way in.
Yeah, like Leeds fixtures turn completely. Honestly, they really turn after the United game. I don't know why we're putting Everton in as this like great big fear, to be perfectly honest with you. And I could totally see why you'd want to put him into your side just to ignore the United game, suck up whatever happens in it. And if if he wipes out a clean sheet that a lot of people tend to have, fine. But at the same time, I personally just want to see what Leeds look like starting off this season as well. Yeah. And they were so reliably good against teams that they're better than last year that I'm kind of quite happy to just wait until they play Burnley or until they play Newcastle before that comes around. That's game week 3 and game week 5.
Fair. All right, let's keep it going. So there's lots of players in the 6.5 sort of area. JWP, Lucy Heinitz told me he was overpriced, so I'm going to stick with that. Tillemont, too deep lying, I'm going to stick with that as well. Obviously, you know, you've got the North London duo, Adam Pritchard's brother from another mother, Bukayo Saka, and our friend, desperate seeking Dusan's man, Dele Alli, both 6.5 with the potential to push on. Of course, they come at it from different angles, so Dele obviously is now kind of on the downward slope of three seasons in the wilderness, but he has one 200 club appearance to his name, and he's not lower than 8.0 price since bursting on the scene in 2015-16. On the other hand, Saka the boy wonder, 114 points, 5 goals, 5 assists last season. Could he make his mark? I don't know. Trossard, improvement year on year price, points wise, 79 points, 118 points. There's very little to commend him to us, frankly, looking at the data. He was second for their non-pen XGI, not very far behind Mopay. West Ham is actually fairly interesting, though, just to kind of link it all together. So Jared Bowen is one who's fairly interesting. 141 points, 8 goals and 6 assists. At 6.5, 141 points, it's kind of what you're looking for, actually, season long. He was Antonio's sloppy second last year, but his data is really bland, to say the least. Like, I couldn't find a headline stat for him. So I spoke to our friend Tom Campbell about him, and he said he's a direct player and that he's obviously the guy who's, when Antonio's injured, he's asked to kind of play in that position. And you know, he played in all 38 of West Ham's games last season as well. So I looked at him when Antonio was injured and not when he was centre forward. So Antonio was out 7-9, 11-15, 31-33. And then Bowen had 11 games deputising. When he was centre forward, he actually had 1 goal and 3 assists. But when he wasn't, it was 7 goals and 3 assists. So it's the case where if Antonio is not in the picture, he's the guy that you don't really want to be looking at because he's going to be kind of playing the false nine role and it's not going to be working for him. On the other hand, though, you've got Suchek, who actually did score a decent amount of his points when Antonio wasn't in the team. So the game, same sort of measure of games that Antonio didn't play in, I looked at for Suchek, and he actually scored 4 out of 10 of his goals during that period and 1 and 2 of his assists. So, you know, in less than a third of the season, he scored 45% of his goal involvements. So maybe there could be some element of Suchek in there. But the big one for me actually is Benrahma at 6. Again, not much from days to commend him. A bit of a pump, really, at that price. Known for being a pretty talented player. You know, FB Ref puts him the 90th percentile for assists and dribbles. But he is one who has been coming up in preseason as being a decent sort of punt, you know, the sort of player who could become one of those who does kind of blow up. And a note from our friend, Blondo's Maldonado as well. West Ham's attack is one of the few who will have played together all pre-season, building that understanding because none of them have been internationals. Whereas others have been a bit bitty due to returns. A small point, but one worth highlighting. But quite a lot there, isn't there, Anthony?
There's an awful lot there to unpack. And I'm not sure if any of it is actually like worth fully taking out of the box and putting into your side. It's just a little bit difficult. Like Benrahma, for example, I think you've summarized so perfectly as a punt. And I think, to be honest, all of those West Ham midfielders fall into that category for me.
Yeah, they're all but aren't they?
Yeah, exactly. It's like, why don't you just spend the extra 0.5, for example, and get Rafinha in then? Because, you know, it's like the stats are just so much better for him, for example. And yeah, like Saka, I felt, has just been that little bit overpriced, fall in as a punt now. 6.5 kind of stretches you that little bit more for him. Sure. If he was 5.5 again, I feel like he'd be making, it would be a much harder, you know, harder decision with him. And then, as you say, Tom, there are so many other players in there where it's very hard to kind of commend them on a stats basis, or you have fears when it comes to their minutes, or they've been promoted and you're not quite sure what's going to come with them this season when they, you know, teams just tend to be very unpredictable when they come up.
There are still players like, you know, Trinchao, Brian Hill, you know, players that I could have mentioned that I didn't.
Yes, yeah, Sarr as well. There's another one.
Yeah, Sarr. What do you think about him? Anything there? I mean, he's been obviously like talisman theory. I did kind of drop him into the kind of the conclusions. I think it was 106, 107 points last time I was in the Premier League. It's really sad that I remember that. It's not even on my notes, actually. I know people know that I've got those notes for this one, but that's not even on my notes. I think, again, it's always punty, isn't it? Even though, you know, he is the talisman.
Like, Sarr was, you know, he was very good in the Premier League when Watford went down 2 seasons ago. And I even had him in my side, actually, for an awful lot of the period before they went down. And like, you know, what that season you only had, what, 5 goals and 4 assists. And I think I might have had him for most of the time up until the week before he got that big
season, wasn't it? Where he
Liverpool
eviscerator.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Yeah, I sold him the week before that, typically. And then last season in the Championship, 13 goals and 4 assists. So like, yeah, okay, he's definitely kind of growing into that side as he kind of grows up himself. But at the same time, again, it's like, is he worth that risk when he's 6.0 and you've got so like established Premier League players at 6.5, for example, who you know are going to return, where you can stretch that little bit more to an awful lot of really good options at 7 and 7.5.
Yeah.
No, I just can't see a reason to do it, personally.
Yeah, or you could even just buy Harrison or something, like, to get into kind of established sort of mode.
Yeah, and just, you know, get your team ticking over and kind of, you know, make some decisions with an early wild card from there. I kind of commend that approach an awful lot, to be honest, this season.
Cool. I think the last one I want to mention here, before we move on to the fringe players, I mean, we could mention Mbeumo, I think his name is actually Brentford. He was playing off Tony in a lot of the friendlies, and he was part of the BMW frontline, actually, not very long ago. But the one I want to mention, actually, at 5.5 is Smith Rowe. We're in my boy territory, and you'll see that he's in my team at that price. Arsenal's new number 10, new contract, 74 points last season, and obviously it's been asked by a few people, quite rightly, you know, this guy's got 2 goals and 5 assists. Why should I be interested in him? Well, he's a young man, the Croydon De Bruyne, and he created more chances and more big chances per 90 than anybody else in the Gunners team last year. And again, Anthony, doing my very crude extrapolation of points, he played 16 games worth of per 90s for those 74 points. So that gives you a points per game or points per 90 of 4.6. So times up with 38, what do you get? You get 175 points. I am not saying Emil Smith-Rowe is going to get 175 points. I'm guessing he'll get about 130, 140 if everything goes to plan this year. At 5.5, that could be a serious bargain. One data point to leave you with here. I'm not going to push this too far, but I do love ESR. Arsenal won 67% of the games when the Croydon De Bruyne started and only won 30% when he didn't. And I think that he plays a very specific role in the Arsenal team, like, you know, the sort of player that we will want to see kind of regenerated for Arsenal, the kind of the Bergkamp-esque sort of playmaker. Obviously, he's not kind of starting from a forward position, dropping back. He's not kind of starting backward and dropping forward. But he's great to watch, and I'm, you know, definitely right in my boy territory.
Yeah, put your neck on the block if you really want to. So they have Arsenal start their season with 2 games against 2 top 6 sides, and then they have 3 games against, you know, arguably three bottom six sides. How many of those games does Emil Smith-Rowe start in?
I think he starts all of them.
I
don't know why this is a question, because the guy's just signed a huge contract. He's now number 10. obviously there's a big kind of vote of confidence in him from Arteta. Maybe it's me and, you know, the fandom sort of edge going on, but I don't really see how it could be different because Ozil's gone.
Ozil wasn't the reason why Smith Rowe wasn't playing last season.
We needed the playmaker, and I think that he has become an integral part from H2 last year, from when he first got into the team. He's got become an integral part to how Arsenal play and how it all kind of fits together. I really do. And I kind of think any questions around will he start feel a little bit kind of in, I don't know. I'm not really too sure that those are questions that are worth entertaining. Just because at the end of the day, if he wasn't the sort of player who's going to start those big games with a Solomon Davila when they offered us 30 million.
No, I don't think so, though. Like a 21-year-old player who clearly has a huge ceiling, you're not going to sell for 30 million when you might be able to get 50 million for him in a year, even if he only plays half the games. Like
I think if he was a player who was in that sort of province where he was a sellable asset, then a deal could have been done.
Yeah, yeah.
We wouldn't have been trying to desperately tie him down to new contracts. I think next year will be really exciting for Arsenal, actually, because we've got no Europe, and you know, you've got lots of Spurs, lots of Leicester, whatever, who did very well without Europe.
I suspect no Europe is going to be a huge, huge benefit to Arsenal next year. I feel like number one, it gets someone like a good coach like Arteta gets a chance on the training ground to really prove his mettle in a way that he just didn't before.
But no midweek
also, it's
games.
Just fatigue. On, it's huge. Just and the fatigue, and not Thursday ones as well.
Yeah,
that they don't have that fatigue problem. I think that the question about minutes is just a viable one until we've seen something different. And it's just, you know, towards the end of last season, Arsenal had very little to play for. So sure, he was playing, but of course they were going to give youth a chance. And, you know, he was playing in the Europa League. Okay, great. You couldn't get too confident about it. And then in the, you know, the weeks before that, we knew he was an important player, but there were injuries that meant that he was getting game time. It's hard to be just fully, fully confident. I really like that you are as confident as you are that he's going to start those games, Tom. That really interests me, just to make sure that your head is firmly on that chopping block. And that would make him very tempting at 5.5, because he is a very good player.
You will see later on that I've got like a little bit of a rotation. So I'm not going to be fielding Smith Rowe. I think
you're not relying on him.
He'll go to first sub during those things. But yeah, no, absolutely. Right. In the interest of brevity, we should move on. Hopefully that was a useful digression. Fringe players, Anthony, incredibly boring in the midfield kind of area. Josh Brownhill was the one who's kind of gone through recently. There's obviously lots of Billy Gilmore. Bissouma is the one who is owned by the actual template, 15% owned in the actual template. But Brownhill, probably the best candidate, the reincarnation of George Boyd, if anyone owned him back in the day.
Oh, wow. What a shout.
He could not stop scoring, could he, off the bench? I think he got very, very lucky. Because I think there were a few weeks where the few notable players didn't play, like Eden Hazard or whatever, and he happened to have scored a goal. And so there's a lot of kind of existential love for George Boyd. Look it up if you're a bit old, if you're a bit younger.
What a memory. I never thought I'd think of George Boyd again. Thank you.
But the second half of the season, Brownhill, had the second most shots behind Bissouma of 4.5 million mids, the most shots on target and the highest XG of all of 4.5 million mids. Yeah, they're not very high numbers. Let's not go into that. And some people might be kind of saying, oh, Murphy at Newcastle, who's worth
the
five?
The reason why Brownhill is in the template is because he scored a brace in a pre-season friendly against some team that I've already forgotten. You know, that's the reason why he got a decent
amount of minutes last year, and he's an okay player. Like, I've owned him a Foot Manager many a time in the Championship. Of course, I should commend any player to anybody, but that's the reality of it. Yes. And at 4.5, you want a player who's likely to play and has some sort of vague attacking edge. And that's basically what Brownhill has. Maybe Gilmore will see that as well. But I think Brownhill was the most likely kind of guy to do that job for you.
Yeah, so just worth saying, I did a thread on fringe midfielders the other day, a sponsored thread on Twitter that you can go and dig up if you want. But, you know, the key data, I guess, that I pulled out from that was, you know, looking at all of these 4.5 and 5.0 midfield options in terms of, you know, stuff like expected goals and big chances and expected assists and clean sheets, because, of course, that matters when you're looking at a player like this, and bonus points, potential and everything. And really, when you looked at the 4.5s and 5.0 midfielders, Brownhill came up well. But the other player who I think is a little bit of a mystery box at that price tag is... Alan at Everton, 4.5. So The thing with him, okay, is that even last season under Ancelotti, when he obviously his minutes weren't, he didn't play as much as we would have hoped. But on a per game basis, compared to the likes of Yves Bissouma, Declan Rice, Brownhill, and Douglas Luiz at Villa, he would have been better in terms of attempted assists per game. He was better in terms of penalty area actions per game. So he's just generally going in the right direction in terms of going up the pitch. Everything you would expect to improve defensively. So Bissouma is much better from a statistical perspective on an awful lot of the expected metrics to do with predictions and algorithms and things, because basically Brighton's XGC is so good. They just expect him to get that extra point for the clean sheet so frequently that he just beats the others just by dint of that. You take that away and he's really not that much better of an option than any of the rest of them. Alan actually stands out. And then if you think that Rafa arriving at Everton, you'd expect him to tighten up defensively, might mean that he'll do a little bit better in terms of picking up those extra points along the way.
3 points per game rather than 2 points per game.
Yes, and he is prone to perhaps finding himself in the box or giving a pass into the box more frequently than most players who cost that much. No. And then, sorry, in the real mystery box, like I called Alan the mystery box, but it's Gilmore is the real mystery box again.
Yeah.
At Norwich, 4.5. Will he play? Don't know. Do we have any good stats to commend to you? No, not really. Like, yeah, we do. But, you know, there are like he played 261 minutes in the league last season. So draw your own conclusions from that. He looks good. He plays well. He might start. If he continues to start, then he could be a very good pick. But for right now, I would actually commend Alan to you at 4.5 over Brownhill.
That's your... just to verbalise this as well, Morgan Gibbs-White has played a couple of games in the friendlies at number 10. Anyway. Let's move on to the goalkeepers. Get out of midfielder sort of zone and then talk about the goalkeepers. So the twin plate duo, I guess, is Sanchez and Foster. They're both owned by about a quarter of managers, although the actual template is squarely on Emi Martinez. It's like Nick Pope a couple of seasons ago. 39% of managers own Emi Martinez at the moment. I don't really know where to go with this. And there's lots of ways to look at it. I guess the key question, Anthony, is Sanchez or bust? Have you looked at this?
Yeah, I have another thread basically that looked at this, and that's kind of the, you know, the key piece of data that I'm drawing on for an awful lot of my analysis here, so you can go and dig that up if you want. But really, Tom, I think when it comes to Sanchez, you are basically asking yourself, can Brighton turn expected clean sheets into clean sheets? Can they do it as much as they did in the second half of last season, when statistically they weren't just one of the best defences in the Premier League, they were one of the best defences in Europe in expected stats? And this is the thing, like, if they can do that, fantastic. Can they do that when White is away? We don't know, for example.
Yeah,
like, can they do it with, they have decent fixtures, and this means that, you know, he finds himself in and the template teams as well. I think, to be perfectly honest with you, he's just such an easy pick for game week one that I feel like I could totally understand why every manager would just pick Sanchez. Just all of the stats point towards it, all of the fixtures point towards it, the price points towards it. There isn't really a compelling alternative at 4.5. I think there's a strong argument for picking Ilan Meslier, because Meslier, basically, in a way that Sanchez doesn't, you know, having good XGC and good XCS in Sanchez's case means basically that he doesn't face many shots. He doesn't have to save much. He doesn't rack up BPSs. Meslier, on the other hand, he's kept busy. He's racking up saves all the time. He's getting his points. Almost, did anyone have any more saves than him last season? I don't think
so. They did. I mean, Martinez did.
Except for Martinez, yeah.
But he had the highest saves per game, actually.
There we go. Yeah, I knew there was one of those stats that he was way out ahead in. And this is the thing. Like, at 5.0, he could really be good value, because that Leeds defense wasn't bad last year. It really wasn't. If it improves even a little bit, it's getting, you know, it's going to be a pretty good return for him. Whereas Martinez at 5.5, it's a little bit harder to make that argument for him. I understand why people might put him in, but at that point, I would say stretch to Mendy and put him into your side for 6.0.
God, now we're getting into, I can never spend more than 8.5 on my goalkeeper. Maybe, you know, I could just about stretch to Meslier. But I never want to spend any more than that. I think you're right on Sanchez. Obvious pick. Obviously, saves per game was 2 last year, but he only played half the season. One thing in his favour I did find was that his baseline BPS for Brighton in the defence, he's actually 2nd behind Dunk. If they have a 1-0 win, he's likely to get a random bonus if that happens. That's obviously very small because of the pass completion. Adam Webster recently signed a new contract, and he was saying that part of the Potter philosophy, the Potter magic, was that the goalkeeper was an option for passing. So he could give it to Dunkey or he could give it back to the goalkeeper. So it meant that Sanchez had this sort of, you know, the pass completion.
BPS racking up.
That BPS sort of options open to him as well because of how Brighton play. A very niche point. But that could also mean that Sanchez, you know, is likely to get you a 7-pointer, where other goalkeepers get you a 6.
Whereas Melier could actually get you a 9.
He could be the kind of guy who shows up, you know, away at Man City, keeps clean sheet and ends up with a 12-pointer. He's that kind of goalkeeper.
Yeah, Sanchez, 2.4 saves per game. Melier, 4.1. That's knocking up that 1 point for a save every time with Melier. You know, that's kind of such a handy thing, you know. Bonus points per game. It's 0.6 bonus points per game for Melier. It's half that, 0.3 for Sanchez.
We can look at this a lot. I think that Sanchez is probably the guy.
Yeah.
Melier is probably the one who's going to play a bit more. You know, we're looking at players, you know, like Guaitar at Palace. People be like, oh, he could be interesting. But look at something like the XGC. Last year, his XGC prevented was minus 12.5. So he let in 12.5 goals. Or 13 goals more than he should have, according to the SGC. It's all a bit yucky. We can't proclaim a new Martinez yet. We're hoping it's Sanchez. Obviously, he was taken off injured, but it was a precaution, apparently. But you know what? Let's just chuck Ederson in, Stag, and enjoy the 50-50 chance of a clean sheet every other game.
Ederson got more points than any Man City defender last
year. He did.
Like, Pep Roulette hit so often and so many things happened to their defenders that Ederson ended up outscoring them. Imagine just dodging all of the headaches and just keeping him there, chugging away, getting a clean sheet every other week. But the thing is, and this is why I mentioned Mendy, because the exact same thing can be said for him. Both the City and Chelsea defense in the second half of the season, City for the whole season, were basically getting a clean sheet every other game. They're just perfect, you know, great. 6.0, 6 points every week or every second week. Great. Great way to get it, you know.
Do you know who the best goalkeeper was last year, though, in terms of XGC?
In terms of XGC per game or...
Overall throughout the course of the season.
No, Tom, I'll...
Alisson, plus 3.9 XGC. That was in the context of Liverpool conceding the most big chances they have in the last 5 years. And Alisson, elite goalkeeper, scoring at one end, obviously, but he stopped the most goals compared to the amount of shots he faced the other team, 6.0. No. Are you ever going to go there? No, of course not. So you're looking probably at Sanchez versus Melier, as we've mentioned. And I'm not too kind of upset about that. So I think Sanchez and Foster...
Yeah, and there's a potential 4.0 option there as well in Foster, isn't there?
Well, maybe. That's one of them, isn't it? But it could happen. But yeah, I completely understand Sanchez. Right, shall we take a break there?
Yes.
Because there's obviously been a lot that we've mentioned during this. Probably give people who are listening a chance to kind of pause it. Let it all percolate for a little while. And we'll be back in a minute to start on the defence.
Who got the assist?
Right, so we're back and we're moving on to defenders now. And so I think let's get us back focused onto that template again, because that's what we're using as the crux of this whole entire podcast, looking at the potential FPL options this season. The template defence is as follows. Trent Alexander-Arnold, Lucas Dean, Luke Shaw, Fofana and Ayling. So what you've got there is, you know, one super premium, two 5.5s and then two in the 4.5 bracket.
Yeah.
Now, the one that really stands out there, of course, is the 7.5 option, Trent Alexander-Arnold. You may have heard of him. He's 28% owned. I think a bit like we were saying about Salah and Bruno, there is a question with TAA. Do you dare to go without Trent Alexander-Arnold in your side?
I think that, yeah, obviously the template is as it is. I think at the moment, for good reason, obviously might see Ben White in there ahead of Fofana or Ayling. Maybe, you know, Brandon Williams is of his world may come in. 4 or 5 years ago, if we're doing this podcast, we'd be thinking value defense and putting all the money forward. Nowadays, it's not quite that way, especially this year. And we'll talk about bigger the back in a minute. Trent-wise, though, do we dare look past him? No. I think he's got prodigious creative and defensive potential. Last year, fifth most chance created, top 10 for XA. His 8 assists was a bit of a drop-off, but it's worth noting that his XA actually moves around a lot season to season. So he's been in the Premier League, you know, as a live asset for 3 years now, In 2019-20, he got 15 assists from an XA of 10 when he was fourth overall. But back in 2018-19, he got 13 assists, so two assists less than in 2019-20, and obviously a fair few assists less than the eight last year. From an XA of just six. So things really seem to veer around for him. It's more about if his teammates can deliver more than anything else. And worth noting as well that Trent actually scored more points than any other player in FPL last season over the last 10 game weeks. He scored 66 over the last 10 game weeks. So obviously when he gets going, he does get going. And I think I captained him actually one week where he did actually score a last minute goal, which was brilliant. Liverpool in general, I think, are due after the Anas Horribilis without BVD. We've added Konate now to maybe revert to the mean. So last season, their XGC was 52.82, and they were also eighth for big chances conceded. So teams like Newcastle, Burnley, Everton all conceded less big chances than they did. But Liverpool actually only conceded the fourth fewest goals in reality. In 2019-20, their XGC was 41. So last year it was 53, actually, almost. But 2019-20, it was 41, and they only conceded 33 goals, so they conceded nine more goals last season. They conceded a lot of big chances, so even with Virgil van Dijk, with the fullbacks playing high, the VVD Gomez axis did mean there were a few big chances created, and anybody who was involved big at the back then will remember the fact that on the counter-attack there was the opportunity every game where they would concede one or two kind of big chances where yeah, all your nerves were on end. And in 2018-19, the magnum opus, really, just 32 XGC and 23 goals conceded. Only 41 big chances conceded. So, I mean, Trent, I think, is one of those players who kind of sits beyond whatever. Like, he basically, like, stats midfield-wise, as mentioned earlier as well, you've got a brilliant goalkeeper in Alisson there. Who basically has the best XGC stops in the Premier League. But Liverpool in general were really interesting, I think, because there is a legitimate case to double up in the defence. Is Robertson better than Jota? I think is probably one of the things here, because for me, I mentioned that, look at my team in a little bit, Robertson versus Jota is the big one for me. So last season, Robbo actually outscored Trent 161 to 260. And comparing the two, they're basically the same player. It's just that Trent's expected profile and per game profile is just a tiny bit better. But actually, more important for me is this sort of, you know, Liverpool question in general in terms of how we set up our teams, which kind of links us back to this kind of twin player idea. Do we go for a third? I mean, I mentioned Jota's per 90 heroics and the comparison between him and Robertson's we're looking at for a second. It's not really due to the data. It's more contextual rather than factual. And it comes down to how you set up your team. So for Jota, if you were going to have your third midfielder being Jota, I actually did ask Twitter about this. I asked them, you know, how are you setting up? Are you doing three Liverpool with Robbo, three Liverpool with Jota, two Liverpool only? There are a few people who do have Mane in there, but you know they're rightly marginalised from society. But the reality is that 51% of 1,119 respondents were going with two Liverpool, 34% were going with Robertson, and 15% were going with Jota. There were likes from of them, you know, Bansy Castle, who were saying, you know, I can't believe Jota's been overlooked. I can kind of get it though. So Jota, you know, obviously price point wise in the pros column, 7.5 midfielder slot, as I mentioned earlier, you know, he occupies that nice space between kind of, you know, Fernandes and the 6.5. His points per 90 brilliance is obviously there. Even if he doesn't play from the beginning, he can do something off the bench. And he's out of position. He's likely to play as a striker. But Jota, if he does play, that's a big bonus because you've got that team sheet shock thing going on, and he's the first man to be subbed normally if he does start as well and doesn't do very well. And he's a bit of a points dodger as well, as I mentioned earlier on, a bit of a poor finish from the cold streak. Whereas Robbo, now he's got that consistency of starts, and I don't think Shimikas is going to be threatening him anytime soon. He's got that clean sheet kind of bounce back ability, I think it's going to happen, and there's more routes to points. So he took more corners last year than Trent, for example. On the minus side, though, Robertson, you know, you need to compromise elsewhere having him, and you'll see that in my team later on. You need a dud forward or a dud mid to kind of make that happen. With Jota, there is this kind of idea that he's a transfer waiting to happen, whereas you don't really have that with Robertson. And the only kind of thing that happens there is that, similar to Jota, you've got a disappointment if he gets subbed off. With Robertson, you've got that kind of, you know, losing that last minute clean sheet that really hurts. And it hurts more. You've got Trent and Robertson both doing it, both losing it. Like, in theory, I think a Liverpool defence is perfect for our zombie teams if you double up and just set them forget. But in practice, we live our team's performances week to week. So it's quite difficult, I think. And I can see why people would, mostly based on the data, kind of be saying, well, if I'm going for Liverpool, I'm going to go with Robertson. But I mean, are you surprised, Anthony, where people kind of saying that that would be the way they go?
I struggle to understand it. I think the double up is kind of the way to go for the start of the season anyway. And it just allows you to do a wait and see on
to just hedge your bets, basically. Yeah,
this is it. Yeah, and I'm not even talking about that from an ownership or points against you perspective. I'm really just thinking about it from the perspective of just like how are Liverpool going to be playing? Like, Jota and Robbo are about the same price, but when Robbo starts the game, he is on course to get a clean sheet. You know, this is the thing, is that, like, and I expect Liverpool to keep clean sheets more frequently and more dependably than they did last season. Like, it was a clean sheet kind of every three games was kind of how it worked out for them last year, you know, give or take a little bit. I expect that to go up to closer to the every other game metric, and that's fantastic. You know, that gives you such a good head start. And whilst Jota is literally, according to XG, 10 times more likely to score, and whilst Robbo is kind of about twice as likely to pick up an assist, those clean sheets make such a difference at that same price point. Absolutely. And it is kind of that transfer waiting to happen thing as well that feeds into this. The thing is that Robbo will just keep chugging away. And I'm trying to be a slightly more disciplined manager this season. And so with that in mind, you know, starting off with that double up and moving away from it, if I really feel the need to, is the way to go. And I think that there is a chance to get, you know, decent results early on by going with that double up. I mean, from an FPL perspective, just because other people are going to be avoiding it because Liverpool had a poor season last year. Absolutely. But it's easy to get away, I think, from the Robbo problem. It's much, much harder to kind of improve Jota to, let's say, a 9.0.
Yeah. With that in mind, something, yeah,
that's why I would be kind of pro that double up at the back.
Well, hold that thought, because for forwards, it means that I think with Robertson, you end up losing a striker in order to keep your team balanced. And maybe that's something that we'll come on to in a little bit. In the premium sort of area, though, you've got the Chelsea and City defenders who are kind of in that kind of space before we get the 5.5s, which we'll speak about in just a second. You know, Man City and Chelsea were first and second for XGC last year, and also in terms of the fewest big chances conceded. Chelsea obviously tied that up considerably under Tuchel. And assisted defence, Diaz, set and forget, and is obviously out there. And Cancelo as well, the forgotten man a little bit. Don't forget, he was the top-owned defender for a little bit last season. He's had a full pre-season. Could be one worth looking at six. And also Chilwell at six for Chelsea. I think with these players, there will come a time when they are in the meta, they're worth considering, people are going to be buying them in. But they've been squeezed out for now, haven't they, Anthony, by the support players in the 5.5 bracket. And I don't think I've seen a year quite like this, where you've got two players who are in the sort of template. Luke Shaw is one, 47% owned. And I think last season, Anthony, we were a little bit kind of unsure about him, weren't we? I think I remember doing a pod when we were kind of figuring out why his XA was where it was and why his chance creation was where it was and why his XA was a bit low, but his chance creation was a bit high. I mean, what do you make of him? Is it that kind of, you know, recency bias sort of element where, because he did well in the Euros, people have been buying him in?
Yeah, I think that's a huge part of the show thing. I think a huge amount of it actually is recency bias. And the fact that he plays for Manchester United as well, United players just tend to be more popular in FPL, is just a thing. And I think those two details are combining to really push him up on the agenda. especially because, like, I guess on the eye, he looks like a particularly good player as well. When he was playing for England, he looks like, you know, the type of player you'd want in FPL. The thing is that, as you say, Tom, last season we found that an awful lot of his chance creation stats were being ballooned by corners, which weren't necessarily doing anything.
Yeah.
He wasn't getting a huge amount of assists, and his underlying data, when you really dug into it, wasn't actually that good. And whilst you would have pretty big expectations of United's defence this season compared to previous years, obviously now that they've got Varane in and all these sort of things, you'd think that that's going to deliver clean sheets that little bit more reliably. I still actually don't understand why Shaw is as nailed into the template as he is. Like, he's one of the most owned players in the whole entire game right now at 47.5% ownership. That seems a little bit excessive to me, especially, you know, like, the Leeds game is their first game of the season. That's an awkward game. Like, I would say that's a very awkward game.
It's not nailed on clean sheet, is it?
No. And so, kind of with that in mind, like, I actually personally do not have him in my side. I have Diaz instead. And it's kind of because of that I just don't necessarily understand the hype.
Yeah, it's a proper FOMO pick, isn't it? I mean, if you look at the data, actually, in terms of points potential for United, well, Maguire actually had the most headed attempts for defender last season.
Oh, but it's always those headers that go back across the box. They're not thumping headers that you want. They're just always that same header that you saw at the Euros over and over again.
Yeah, like, he's no Gareth McCauley, is he?
Let's put it that way. Kevin Nolan played for Manchester United, second ball.
But I'm much more excited by another 5.5 who's in the template. That's Lucas Digne, or Lucas Dinier, I think, as you called him earlier on. It's a bit of a pronunciation issue, actually, Anthony. That's poor of you.
Yeah, we need to really dig into this one. I'm still not 100% sure.
I think it's Luca Dean, but maybe I've been conditioned by always cheating in a Dean's list. Who knows? But anyway, so he was actually second for XA amongst defenders last season. He got 9 assists as well, so second for assists amongst defenders. 120 points, which is a bit rubbish, actually, the second season in a row. And I think we all maybe are a bit guilty when we look at Lucas Digne of falling prey to availability heuristic. But remember 18-19, so as a very kind of retrievable memory, that's what availability heuristic is if you were on our Behavioural Science podcast, where during that kind of famous run-in where we all saw Everton players because they didn't have a double game week, he went into that kind of period where he couldn't stop scoring. Famously, one week he got a brace, the next week he got a red card. But there was a lot of kind of returns for him there. I guess what really interested me with Lucas Digne is that Rafa's come in and I think he could up the ante defensively. Digne is likely, because of reasons to have the set piece monopoly shared with James, maybe, but it looks like James is actually not going to also be at the club by the sounds of it. So he's got a good chance of keeping up that assists ratio that he's got at the moment. But Rafa in should mean that defensive solidity might accompany that attacking potential that Dean's got. He's going to keep those set pieces, but it might mean that those 5-6 pointers turn into 9-10 pointers, which is going to be quite big for him. And I also noticed that Digne is second for bonus in Everton's team, and he's further based on BPS. So a clean sheet and assist, if they do 1-2 goals per game, is likely to mean that he's in the mix for bonus, especially if, you know, keep clean sheet, you know, marginal gains and all that. One smaller side, though, Rafa might curtail him a little bit in terms of getting forwards. The reason I say that is looking at Marcelo's data at Real Madrid during Rafa's season there in 2015-16. There was a huge drop-off in Marcelo's goals and assists per 90 in 2015-16 compared to the other season surrounding it. So it means that Digne maybe has to defend more and play more of a, you know, in football manager parlance, a support or a defensive role rather than an attacking one. But, you know, against Millonarios, he did get forward to do stuff. But I think Digne could be given that kind of platform because he's got that defensive solidity alongside having set pieces, alongside being able to kind of, you know, provide early crosses into the box. We'll get on to DCL in a bit where I'll expand on that a bit more. I think Digne is one that I'm actually quite interested in, especially I don't have DCL at the moment. I think he could be one who I'm happy to kind of cover that with. And I think he could be one who's got a high upside for that price point.
Yeah, actually, funnily enough, you looked at Marcelo. I looked at Rafa Benitez is last consistent left back in the Premier League, which is actually Matt Ritchie at Newcastle.
Converted wing back though, right?
Yeah, converted wing back, but in the same way that Luka Dina is a very attacking player, I would say the same with Matt Ritchie as a left back in the type of left back that they try to play as. And like, he wasn't too curtailed, you know, again, a bit like Dina, he was benefiting from the use of set pieces and things, but you know, he tipped away nicely. He got his points, got his shots in, etc. There was certainly nothing in that data to put you off per se. But like, Rafa Benitez is a very pragmatic manager. He uses the tools that are at his disposal. And I think Dina's foot and DCL's head are two, you know, particularly useful tools in that Everton team.
Absolutely. Beyond the 5.5s, I mean, there's lots of ways we could do it. There's obviously Matt
Doherty
at Spurs, who two or three seasons ago, he averaged actually over 10 big chances per season on Nuno as well. But it depends on Nuno sets up under Spurs, because at the end of the day, Nuno did sanction his sale. But the big one, I said to him actually on the first podcast back, I'm going to return to him again, is Vladimir Šufal. So I think he was a 5.0, but he was one who it basically is a 5.25. And I think Josh Moore is cheating, basically said he was one goal away from being 5.5. And I think that's pretty spot on, to be honest. But last year, he was equal sixth for chances created with Cancelo and fifth for XA amongst defenders. Everyone else around him, though, so Cresswell, you know, we could point at, you know, before he got injured in game week 31, he was nigh on for 200 club, actually, Cresswell. But Šufal, I mean, he's surrounded by players, actually, at his price point, at the points he scored last season. Robertson, Trent, Cresswell, Shaw, Dean, they all had set pieces to some extent to puff up their XA data. Mm-hmm. Whereas he was fifth for XA. And what's really interesting about him is that he actually created 45 chances last year. 10 of them were big chances, 22%. So more than one in five of the chances he created were big chances. No defender had a better ratio than that. And in fact, only Kevin De Bruyne and Harry Kane had better big chances to chance creative ratios than him in the Premier League last season. Oh, I'm talking to myself into him again. But I think that's actually pretty amazing. 5.0, like, I feel like if he can replicate that again, Anthony, he could be one who's worth looking at.
Completely, that is the case. I think the one thing that needs to be borne in mind if you're putting a West Ham defender into your team, though, and especially with the likes of Cresswell and Šufal, because they're not that dependable from a clean sheet perspective. So you're kind of hoping for getting their attacking returns, which could come against anybody. And so I kind of feel like all of the returns that a West Ham defender might offer you are completely unpredictable. And so unless you're committing yourself to playing them week in, week out, I don't think they're the pick for you. Benching them will definitely lead to heartbreak in a way that you couldn't almost say the same thing for any other team's defenders. I think they're just, these two are particularly kind of well teed up for that. At 5.0 though, he is a really, really, really tempting option. I've really considered him strongly actually. And I'm just kind of averse to West Ham. And I think I kind of start the season like this every year where I just don't know how that team will gel together. This was a thing that was a bit of a narrative last season that West Ham did better because they didn't have a crowd there, you know, getting on the back of David Moyes and playing David Moyes football in the most odd way possible, because this is just not the narrative with any other Premier League team. Will West Ham get worse because their fans have returned? It can be really interesting to see. Kind of all of those details in mind, I don't want to commit to a West Ham defender because I don't want to commit to playing them every week when I feel there is so much value to be had elsewhere. And as well, they have a few decent attacking players.
And you've got Wilson as well, which we'll come on to in just a little bit.
Yes.
So you don't want to do that to game week one. Elsewhere on the 5.0 is, there's also one guy that's worth mentioning a little bit, which is Lewis Dunk. And obviously he had a toe injury, he's had a long planned operation not very long ago. He'll be back for their next friendly. But last year, actually, he was second per attempts behind Maguire. And he had the highest, Anthony, XG for in defender, 4.15. Brighton don't play a top four team in the first eight game weeks. So people are going to think, oh, should I pay an extra 0.5 for this guy?
Interesting, actually, just the vagaries that come with XG data. The XG data that I'm looking at, he's only listed as fifth in terms of XG, 2.1, which just kind of shows you how kind of, you know, they're still subjective, these things are. Go listen to our summer specials to see more of that.
I've got hub data here, I think.
I'm using Fix, so it's Opta. Yeah, yes. But, you know, it just shows you the vagaries of these things. Yeah, I think Dunk is obviously a good option. I think the problem with Dunk is that unless you want to double up on the Brighton defence, and like at that point, I think alarm bells need to be ringing in your head if you're talking about doubling up on the Brighton defence, I think, ahead of the start of the season, especially if you're going to do that by spending 4.5 on Sanchez and another 5 on Dunk. I think it's just too much to ask. There are so many good options there at 5.0 and even 5.5 if you make that stretch. To put Dunk in to get Brighton clean sheets seems like a little bit of a waste when there are perfectly good 4.5 defender options there from Brighton.
Absolutely. The other 5.0 is to cover off. Obviously, you've got lots of Tesco Bag, Tierney, Semedo, you know, Soyuncu and co. One that could be thrown into the mix is covering the Martinez potential big ouchie, given the ownership. Mm-hmm. So I looked at this very briefly. I couldn't find anything to basically recommend any of the Villa defence. Cash, Konsa, nowhere. Target, ninth for chances creators. Mings had 15 head attempts last season, targets at the occasional corner. I mean, you're really kind of clutching at straws, and I don't like them at all. I think we'll leave it there and we'll move on to the fringes, which is obviously looking at Fofana and Ayling. Fofana, boring pick, whatever, mere player. Basically, the only data he's got is he could keep clean sheet. And Johnny Evans has got plantar fasciitis, which means that he can sometimes he's not going to be playing. Ayling, I think, could be really interesting. So as our friend Seb Wassell always points out, Ayling actually had the highest XGI versus actual goal involvement gap of any player last season. So his XGI was 4.9 higher than his actual returns. So no returns there. I can see why he's also in, you know, the meta, as it were. And surely that's not going to happen again. 4.5, so Anthony, is there anybody you're favouring here?
It's an extremely difficult question. I can see why Ayling kind of stands out just from those kind of chances created perspective. You could kind of point at the likes of Loughton as well in that kind of, you know, cheap accessible category.
Oh yeah, no, he's on the list there.
yeah. But to be honest with you, I think now that Ben White has moved to Arsenal, he has kind of superseded all the rest of them, just because Arsenal's defense is actually quite good and has improved, you know, markedly in recent times. Towards the end of last season, it was actually starting to become a defense that you could buy into. And now having a 4.5 option in there, I think makes that a pretty easy choice. I think Fofana is such a tempting option, but number one, okay, yeah, you've got the plantar fasciitis, as you say, with Evans. That means that Fofana will get his game time, but Fofana has competition for centre back berths if they're playing two centre backs, and Leicester's defence hasn't actually been that good anyway. Mm-hmm. And so, with that in mind, I don't understand really the kind of the push for him. I think people have just kind of gone with, oh, Leicester, they finished high last year. Oh, Fofana, 4.5, great. Yeah. And kind of put him into the side. And I don't think there's much more to that. Ayling, as I say, the chance to create it makes it tempting. I do wonder, and I'd love if someone could look at the data, is it just because the fact that Ayling is crossing from a side that ends up landing balls on Bamford's weaker foot means that he doesn't end up getting as many assists as he might? It's the sort of thing, like, it's a very kind of, like, you know, FIFA diagnostic, but possible. So it would be unusual, to say the least, if that was the case. But either way, it's just those early difficult fixtures for Leeds, a bit like we were talking about Rafinha earlier, means that he doesn't find his way into my initial squad. But I think that Leeds defense, and we were talking about Melier earlier, will offer pretty good value at times, and Ayling is, you know, the cheap route into it that might produce something for you attack-wise too.
I just think overall, these are a set of players who are proper fringe. You know, they're the kind of player who is going to be first sub, second sub. It's not like the days of old where this kind of player would be your 11th man. I think they're kind of firmly on your bench. I mean, I've got, you know, Veltman at the moment, basically, because if you look at his data, he had the first best XA of the 4.5s left in the Premier League after last season. And he obviously is quite versatile. So he could play in the centre-back role, he could play in the right wing-back role if Lamptey's not around. But you're, you know, Ben White, I think, is probably going to be, as you said, the one who, logically, if you were going to be making a zombie team, would be the one who'd be thrown in. Just because at the end of the day, I think you'd be expecting him to get 130, 140 points. Perfect. That's what we're looking at. Aiden could do that as well.
Yeah, and then just in the to watch, but fixtures means that they're not initially in our plans. The likes of Cody, I would say, is in that. Joachim Andersen at Palace, just because he was such a menace at corners for Fulham. I could see a team that's in transition just trying to pick up a few goals off corners, taking the easy option with him. So he could be a pretty interesting option for Palace when their fixtures turn, but their fixtures are just diabolical for ages. And then, then there's the Burnley too of Loughton and Taylor, but not now.
I think Loughton actually was the most creative of this lot. You're really scraping the barrel, aren't you?
Yeah.
And 4.0, sure. Let's not even go there. I mean, you've got Omid Bamideli at Norwich. You've got Brandon Williams at Norwich.
Potential Brandon Williams, yeah.
Ankeo. I mean, there's no Wan-Bissaka. There's no Lindstrom this season, as far as I know. So it sounds like we're broadly questioning the 4.5s there in the template. We kind of know why they're there. It kind of makes sense that they're in the template. So there it kind of goes. I think let's move on to the forwards. The three who are in the forwards kind of option are Watkins, Antonio. Antonio is a bit contentious. I originally put DCL in there, actually. And Tony, although his ownership actually has declined, I think it's around kind of 40% mark, and now it's around the third mark. But one of the things that obviously is noticeable is that the premium strikers are left out of the swim plate at this point. Is that because of big at the back? Is that because of, the fact that, in midfield, you're looking at Bruno and looking at Salah? Probably yes. And also because there's an uncertainty about Kane. I was on Twitter. 29% of people own Kane in their teams. So there's huge ownership. And that's obviously due to him being the Tasman King last year. They all read Tasman Theory, as far as I'm concerned. It's worth restating the findings of that one more time. Obviously, last year, he was the Golden Boot, Golden Sister. And it was a huge turnaround for Kane. We've all kind of brushed past it due to hindsight bias, I think, a bit. Creeping determinism, the I knew it all along effect. Last season, we looked at him really skeptically. We were laughing at people who had him in game week one, game week two. And I looked at last year's notes for this, Anthony, when we were doing this. And I noticed in that his exit velocity from last season was something to behold. But there was nothing else apart from that, because I kind of was too busy focusing on Anthony Martial. Because after his ridiculous project restart, I wanted to fit him into my team. But Kane's still a player who comes with a guarantee, wherever he is, of scoring 15 goals per season. It's just the contextual uncertainty about him which is throwing people off. If he goes to City, which is probably where it's interesting at this point, I think he becomes pretty damn sexy, actually. He's not mobile, really, but I like to think about how Pep changed Kun Aguero. So Aguero used to be a poacher or an advanced forward football manager parlance before Pep got his hands on him. Now, don't forget, Jesus came in and there was lots of chat. Remember the infamous Jamie Jackson moment ahead of Huddersfield in game week 2, 2018-19?
Oh my word, I'd forgotten.
Yeah, which I think still means that Jamie Jackson hates FPL. But anyway, there was a friction, allegedly, between Pep and Aguero. But I think Kane does what Pep wants Aguero to do. Leads the line, gets involved in the play, he's a lovely striker with the ball. But I feel like in some ways, he's the ideal kind of integrative striker that Pep is looking to spearhead a team of his. A creative player who is lethal as well when offered a chance. But at the time of recording, he's not showing up to training. So I think he could be left out of the mix. And I think, Anthony, the likes of him, Vardy, Aubameyang, Werner, Firmino, basically everybody down to Dominic Calvert-Lewin at 8, they've all got problems with them, haven't they?
Easy answer, short answer, yes. It's the risk, I think, more than anything that means that none of these other options are interesting. So like someone like Vardy, I think you could build a case for, you would say that he's, he is aging and he's changing his profile. And so now you're depending on penalties and assists and, getting the odd goal and all this sort of thing. You could point to some of the Arsenal players, Aubameyang pretty much, and say, I think that Arsenal are going to turn the corner. But it's hard to. Bamford is the one you could point to and say 8.0, it's just that it's high, but it kind of brings him into that just above all of the 7.5 and 7 options that we have. And I think that actually makes him a premium, just because he's not one of them. And even for him, I think you can start to kind of construct arguments against him based on fixtures and things, but also based perhaps on all the tropes that used to be associated with him before he surprised everyone last year with a really, really good season. That is why we've just ended up kind of all falling into this kind of 7.5 and 7 to maybe 6.5 trap, isn't it?
Yeah, basically the template is Watkins, Antonio, Tony. Watkins owned by 35%. Tony by 32% and DCL on 27%, Bamford's 18% owned, and Nacho 40% owned. Basically, we've got a mid-priced forwards glut in this kind of support area. Are we realistically, basically, Anthony, fishing in the same pool of players? Are we looking at basically kind of making three or two or three from four or five? Watkins, Tony, DCL, Antonio, and maybe Bamford seem to be the ones for me.
Callum Wilson, I would throw into that as well.
Yeah, that's what I'd throw into.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it is. And I think you can, again, it's a bit like this. You can construct arguments in favor of all of them. So, you know, you look at the likes of Watkins and you can point to, obviously, his returns last season. You can point to the fact that he was able to do it and Grealish wasn't in the team. His stats were good. You know, his exit velocity, as you would have called it in Talisman Theory, was pretty good as well. Tony, you point to, obviously, his record in the Championship where he was absolutely out. Phenomenal. DCL, I think you're pointing to the start of last season. This is the thing with DCL, and I find it quite interesting. And then you're also pointing at the fact that Everton's fixtures are pretty much far and away the best of any clubs kind of in the first 6, 8, 10 game weeks. Mm-hmm. Antonio, it's a little bit more difficult, but I think this is just me revealing my reticence on West Ham again, that with him, I've just been burnt too many times as well, with injuries
I'm exactly the same. Yeah. That I find it hamstrings, yeah.
Yes, and like no matter how good his underlying stats often are when he's playing, and just, you know, for example, even in the final, you know, the second half of last season, like he's right up there in terms of XG. He's the third best for forwards for XG behind only Iheanacho and Kane. He's fantastic. And Iheanacho is one we haven't mentioned it here. He's kind of getting the raw end of this deal because we've kind of put question marks, I think, back over his game time just because of Daka and because of the Vardy stuff and everything, but also just because Leicester's fixtures are a little bit tough. But the thing with him and Iheanacho, I think, could be a decision that the template comes to rue is excluding him.
It depends on the Community Shield, doesn't it? Like, if he shows up in a game and he does a goal, then suddenly he's in every team.
Yeah, but this is it, Tom. Like, he could score a 1 yard tap in that he, you know, got through absolutely, you know, through no skill of his own. Like, it could just be a spill by Ederson. And suddenly we're going to find that Iheanacho is going to be a must buy player. And at 7.5, like given his exit velocity last season, honestly, if he was priced 8 or 8.5, I wouldn't have been surprised. And so that 7.5 price tag looks very, very tempting. And also, you know, he didn't have a Euros, which helps.
No, absolutely. I think that's basically it with Iheanacho. I think it's just one of those things where, no, it's not Football Manager. He's not going to be something he drops. I'm assuming he's going to play that game against Man City. It's just that with Daka, with Barnes, with Vardy, how is it all going to fit together in the sharp end of Leicester? And that's a tough one. Just dive into these players. I mean, Bamford, hero of Talisman Theory. I don't want to bang on about this guy too much. Many people have basically said, you know, 8 million is too much. But he was involved in 45% of the 62 goals last season for Leeds. That's just silly, actually. If you think about a team who, to the eye test, were wave after wave of white shirts piling forward, he was sitting from Talisman Theory. Okay, I'm banging on again. But I think maybe we hinge again on the hindsight bias because he's 8 million now, but he scored 194 points last season.
Yeah,
there's definitely a case that, you know, he could potentially be a bit kind of fixture proof almost. I mean, I think we remember him at the end of last season, you know, coming off after 60 minutes a lot, or before 60 minutes a lot. But actually, he was actually only subbed in game week 34 and 36 before 60. So I think that we kind of all owned him around that sort of time. We all kind of felt that. But could that 194 points be his yah-yah year? But last year, he had, you know, the most shots in the box, most shots on target, most big chances, most XG. And he was second to Kane for his actual goals scored amongst strikers. And, you know, his opening games are United, Everton, Burnley, Liverpool. And maybe the ones to have your eye on, basically. I think that could be one that's interesting. Calvert-Lewin, though. Yeah, I think you're probably right about him being one who slowed down a lot. 13 of his 16 goals were scored by February. last year. So 80% of his output was done by February. It was all over then. He was done. It was over. It was all over for him. But there's a really good point, actually, by always cheating Brandon about Rondon and Newcastle and how Rafa made him do his job.
First Boyd, now Rondon. I'm really getting throwbacks.
I'm definitely kind of, you know, replaying all the classics. But I did a comparison between Rondon when he was at West Brom and Rondon when he was at Newcastle. And his role really changed, actually, if you look at the stats. So his expected stats actually increased by a third under Rafa. His frequency of shots in the box increase, his goal involvement off the charts, but actually he had far fewer touches of the ball, and his heat map actually showed him being in the box a lot more. And maybe that may happen DCL, where he's not actually dropping back. He's more kind of, you know, sixth position sort of thing. And actually DCL was a lot more accurate with his shooting than Rondon. So 55% last season shots on target for DCL versus, you know, when Rondon was in his prime of Newcastle back in the day. So he could be actually be really interesting. And what's really interesting as well is the contextual data where you kind of read that there's crossing practice going on in Everton training. You know, the likes of Dean, the likes of Andrews Townsend, the likes of Demarai Gray are kind of feeding in chances.
I do feel like that's a real, you know, we've picked out an article that suits, not accusing you, but I feel like that's a real article that's been point that's been picked out. It's like there isn't a team in the Premier League that doesn't do crossing training, you know, and it's just kind of like, that's been picked out because it kind of just fits the trope with that Newcastle team.
I haven't got Calvert-Lewin at the moment. Who I do have is Watkins, who's in the template. I think that's fixtures, I think. So you'll see in front of you if you're watching or if you're listening, Watford, Newcastle and Brentford in the first three games. So two promoted teams in the first three fixtures, two home games as well in the front three. Mm-hmm. And the key stats with Watkins, we mentioned him actually, I think in the first pub we did back. I've done a little bit more kind of digging on this. So obviously XG of 16.28, 14 goals, whatever. That's pretty decent for the first season of the Premier League. But he actually hit the woodwork, Anthony, seven times. That's actually only Harry Kane hit the woodwork more last year. And he also had two goals ruled out by VAR. That's joint first amount of goals ruled out by VAR. I mean, you count in two of those goals hit the woodwork going in. One of those VAR goals, like, you know, suddenly he's got 18 or 19 goals. And suddenly he is 8.5 plus. So potentially he could be one who I can completely understand basically why he's into Wembley.
Look, we've talked about the 200 club quite a lot in this episode and in previous episodes. I think with Watkins, I'm not saying that he will be in the 200 club, but one of the kind of like entry criteria usually for being in the 200 club is being capable of getting to double figures for both goals and assists. He is more than capable. He was one short in terms of assists. He got 9 assists. He was just on it. Bamford actually did it. I didn't quite get there, but you know, a hair's breadth. Someone else hit the post probably off some pass he gave. And you know, you're just like, there you go. Like that's how close he got to it. And I think he does have that link up play that kind of provides you with that second outlet for points in a way that like you could also say for Raul Jimenez or indeed Bamford, as I was saying too.
No, absolutely. All right. So Raul Jimenez, yeah. I mean, let's keep an eye on him. Game week 4. When their fixtures turn. But I think there's a couple of other guys to mention here. We mentioned Antonio already. Tony, I think you mentioned a little bit earlier on. Even the likes of FPL Salah, my friend Abdul, has broken his rule on Tony just because he kind of noted that there's no one between the 6 to 7 kind of million kind of price points that are interesting given the fixtures for Tony. Obviously, it's Chris Wood at 7 or whatever. And even B&M, Fernando's Miles Nardo, has basically said that Tony, outside of overthinking, is not worth not starting with. It was actually involved in 52% of Brentford's goals last season, Tony. I think it's a FOMO pick, but I'm happy to go with it. But there's Callum Wilson, which I think we should probably just meditate on here before we hit towards the end. Just because I know he's your man, and he was also a proper hero of Talisman Theory this year. 12 goals, 6 assists last season, 134 points, beset by injury problems. I mean, he actually had his lowest kind of game time of the last 3 years, but he was still involved in 37% of Newcastle's goals and a massive 51% of the goals scored when he was actually on the pitch. It was the second time in the last 3 years he's done this, where he's got over 50% of the goals scored from the team he plays for when he's on the pitch. So at Bournemouth in 2018-19, he actually was involved in 52% of the goals that they scored. But he's a proper talisman, isn't he? And he also loves playing West Ham, who he plays up first. I remember Hamble Gate a little while ago when he was at Bournemouth. And he scored against each of Newcastle's opponents in the first four games recently. A proper set and forget. Anthony, you're a big fan of Wilson, aren't you?
Yeah, he just always finds his way into my FPL team, and he always seems to find a way to provide points for my FPL team. And these are, you know, important features of FPL, is having a player who gets points for your team. And I just like it. Yeah, part of it is the fact that, you know, he does come out so well in talisman theory. Like, it's ridiculous how much Newcastle rely on him, and previously Bournemouth relied upon him. And he is a very, very good player from that perspective. Yeah. Injuries are a problem. And even I actually got a bit unlucky last year with him and just didn't quite work out for me in that sense. But I still got a nice few points off him. But like, if you just sort even last season, which I think we would all agree was an off season for him, not as off as the last season at Bournemouth, but an off season because of his time out or whatever. 12 goals, 6 assists. If you sort per game, he was 4th for strikers for goals. If you sort per game as well, for assists, he was 8th for strikers. And in terms of FPL points, the golden thing, because of all those sweet, sweet bonus points he was getting because nobody else in Newcastle does anything, he was 3rd for points per game for forwards. Yeah. The man's a prodigy. Like, it's just incredible. He just prints points when he manages to make it onto the pitch. West Ham first, who I fancy to potentially be serially flaky. Then you've got Aston Villa. And I think he's just the perfect character to be the heartbreaker of the FPL community, or those managers who happen to have Martinez. Southampton, they're Southampton, they're beatable. And then there's Man United, and like, he's entirely prone to scoring against Man United.
There's no game. The BS 90th-minute penalty.
This is it. Don't watch the game. Do not watch the game. Don't even watch the highlights. Just check out the stats at the end and just count your points and, you know, just be delighted with yourself and just be smug. But don't ever watch him. Never watch him, because
I genuinely do quite want him.
It's hilarious. Like, you look at all 38 fixtures and I'm just like, yeah, I could totally see him scoring.
Final thing to kind of cover off here in the fringes for the striker territory. No one's in Twembley, 6.0 to 4.5, or 5.5 actually to 4.5. Davis, Keenan Davis, Fergie's mate, highest own 8%. Any bargains down here? Not really. Not quite yet, at least. So Pookie could get there.
I think there's one bargain in there, Tom.
Okay, fair enough. So Pookie get there. One to watch from game week 4. 11 goals, 3 assists last time he was in the Premier League. And Talisman King, he did dry up January last time he was in the Premier League. Didn't score again in the Premier League after scoring the consolation versus Spurs in game 24 last year. And the Josh King, 5.5. Some hefty points totals under his belt. But remains to be seen which of the thousands of forwards, I think there's about 10, are given game time. Before I move on, what have you found? What gem have you unearthed here?
I've been browsing the talent of Northern England, and I have honed in on Turf Moor. Homed in on Turf Moor. And what I've realized is that Chris Wood is not there. That's the key detail. He's at the Olympics, or he has been at the Olympics. And so that leaves a Burnley striker at 5.5 who needs to be playing. Who's it going to be? I don't know. But I suspect it's going to be sometimes Austria's finest, Ashley Barnes. Yeah, that's the potential option in there at 5.5. If you're really trying to plug a hole in your team, you'll be there to score the inevitable goal against Brighton in game week 1. But there is a bunch of other players in there, most of whom play for Watford, and most of whom you don't want.
Vidra, whatever.
Oh, yeah, but like, this year anyway, it doesn't seem right now anyway that the bargain basement strikers are going to be interesting.
It's one to watch, isn't it, more than anything?
Yeah, yeah.
All right, so other thoughts then, basically. What's your overall view of the pricing this season, Anthony?
They've given us some difficult choices. as they should do. I'm not sure if they've given us enough difficult choices when you look at things on a micro level, on a per team basis. Like, for example, the Mane thing really annoys me. The fact that United maybe, you know, they could have classified one of their midfielders as a striker just to cause a little bit more headaches in the way that they did with Aubameyang.
We haven't mentioned Cavani forward. Here. I mean, that he's, again, one of those players who could kind of...
Briefly came up. Yeah, I don't think so. Like, maybe he might. It's just early on, again, people just aren't sure what to do with him. I think overall it is good. The lack of 4.5 defenders is quite interesting. I think in previous years we've had far more decisions to make in that price bracket.
Maybe that's Lamptey, though. I think without Lamptey, it becomes really boring. But with who could play every game week for the first 8 games.
Yeah, there are plenty. Okay, yeah, fair enough. But there are plenty of other 4.5 options, even Brighton ones, that you could be picking and, you know, doing that for. And, you know, they're as likely as Lamptey, basically, to do anything.
Lamptey is as lively as Lamptey, are they?
Almost nobody's as lively as Lamptey. That's the overall view of the pricing. That there are odd gaps where, you know, the 4.5 defenders, I would have expected there to be more headaches. There's a whole, like, section of midfielders that I would have expected there to be more headaches that there just isn't right now. And then in strikers, obviously, it is very odd that basically everyone north of 8 million is just out of question right now.
Yeah, I agree. Every year, I think, throws up his own kind of set of questions. I remember last year as well, you know, we were all contending with, you know, City and United missing game week one. I remember I was making the case on this kind of equivalent podcast for having Martial on your bench. And every year as well, you have your set of kind of nail players that you don't really think about too much. So this year, for me, it's Salah, Trent, Bruno, Watkins, Dean, Short and Foster. Foster, yeah, 4.0, wow. But none of them have really left my team. I've not really thought about them. And you'll be building around them in practice. So it means you've got kind of, you know, just over half of your team maybe to tinker with. Well, 88 spots this year that I'm tinkering with. And this year, I think more than ever, it's about getting balance right in terms of price points. And as you mentioned, as we've mentioned, there's lots of attractive defensive options and big at the back could perhaps be back because you've got Trent, you've got Dean, you've got Shaw. And...
I have the Ward at the moment, which is White, Alexander Arnold, Robertson, Diaz, and then the bit of it is Dina. Yeah.
And I think there's definitely that. And I think that in the midfield and in the striker spots, you've got kind of a lot of players that FPL have hedged their bets on, basically. You know, could Watkins take off? Could Jota take off? You know, they're all kind of in the middle kind of area, you know, kind of a homogenous kind of blur. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of the time, actually, for me, kind of homes in on whether you kind of take a third Liverpool player, just because the beginning of the season Liverpool is pretty decent. I think there is definitely a lot of interest in terms of, if you are able to look past last season, Liverpool basically have, you know, they do face Chelsea in game week 3, Man City in game week 7, but 6 of their first 8 opening games are not bad at all. And there is, to move on to my team here, a lot of kind of questions surrounding triple Liverpool or not. Just because I think Robertson knocks out the third striker for me. I mean, I've got a weird magnetic attraction to Wilson. Maybe I've been sort of, you know, incepted by you. But I can't really work out where I go here, really, because I feel like I just have the first striker. But do I trust Jota to make it all kind of fit together? Or do I hedge it completely and go with, you know, TAA Salah or something else? Or, you know, do I have the courage to go no brew? I'm not really too sure.
For those on audio, I think the thing that's key to note about your team is that your bench as it stands is Brownhill, Veltman, and Davis.
And yeah, Brownhill, and the whole basically, team is Sanchez in goal, Trent, Robertson, Shaw, Dean in the back, Salah, Fernandes, Havertz, ESR, and then Tony and Watkins being the striking duo.
It's the Brownhill that is your bench that makes me quite concerned. You know,
but he's going to play. He did actually play the majority of the games last year.
No. I'm using his name as a descriptor. it's just not a particularly good bench, you know.
Yeah,
like, okay, Veltman plays, Brownhill tips along, and then you've got Davis.
Yeah.
You're a hitter using two free transfers away from fixing something.
Yeah, maybe I think you're in the kind of the Adam Pritchard sort of ultra cautious sort of area.
I'm not particularly
worried about that. Doesn't worry me at all.
Are you going to wildcard early? Do you think?
I'm not too sure about that. I'm not too sure. I think that because you can. What I didn't like about this team, and I'm any way locked, is that I've got to take kind of Smith Rowe out game week two, game week three when they play Chelsea and Man City potentially, and throw in Veltman, who's on my bench as you for the Watford Neveson game. I think that is a nice enough kind of starting point. The big one for me, as I said earlier, is basically having that kind of third Liverpool player, because Robertson basically means that I don't have that third striker. And do I want Wilson in there? Do I want to get rid of Robertson and having 4.5 million with defender? Maybe. I'm not too sure yet. I do like this squad, but I'm just not too sure.
I would ask you to show the viewers at home the alternative choice, the hourglass approach, which doesn't quite do what you've said there, but still manages to have three strikers.
Yeah, that's something that also has crossed my mind. But am I going to have five at the back? I mean, at the beginning of the season, when the games have not been played, you're like, oh, that's really interesting. The reality is, when you've actually sat through games where you've got, you know, five defenders going, yeah, it's tough. Anthony, so how are you set up? Looking at this, you are in a 5-3-2, so you're in the inverse triangle formation.
Yes, the Christmas tree.
You've gone with Alexander-Arnold, Robertson, Ben White, Diaz and Dean, and in midfield, Salah, Bruno Fernandes, and you've also ended up in that pitfall with the 6.0 midfielder.
And Traore, it's great.
Somehow Tony's ended up on your bench.
That's just week one. Yeah.
Right.
There's a decision there between, do you play White away to Brentford or Tony at home to Arsenal? Mm-hmm. You know, there's a bit of a debate there. Like, I can't say that I love this team or anything, but I certainly like the defense.
It's a 4-3-3, isn't it? You're going to play Tony over White. That's the foregone conclusion, and have Tony, Wilson and Watkins, which I think is the three up front I want.
I again have Brownhill on the bench, and you could, I guess, arguably describe my defense as a Brownhill as well, in that, like, it's got Brownhill and Alan, the previously mentioned hero of the bargain basement midfielder category. And then, of course, it has Tony. So, you know, it's like, whereas you have, let's say, a playing useful asset in Veltman, I have Tony or White, for that position.
I have ESR, who becomes game week two, that guy, and then Veltman plays. So I end up with, same as you, having a bum heavy kind of thing.
Yeah, and I like it though. So I've got my obligatory Brighton defense thing going on with Sanchez. I want to double up on Liverpool. I'm not particularly interested in Jota right now. So that's TA and Robertson put in. I can't really get into any of the debates to have one of the cheaper Liverpool defenders instead. White, I'm quite happy with as the 4.5 option. And I don't really feel the need to squeeze down to 4.0. Especially that, like, okay, really. I bring him down to 4.0. just to make a fodder, for example. Like, it's not like there's some 5.0 midfielder that I really want that I would upgrade to from Brownhill or Alan. There's just no benefit there that really kind of tempts me. Diaz, I want a Man City defender. I think there's a real chance to get ahead there that other people just aren't really buying into. So Diaz is in there as the nailed of them. And then Dean is in. He's the most recent inclusion to this defense. It was actually only when I did a bit of a thread the other day that I really kind of homed Tom in on the Dina. There's a lot of interest there, you know. There's really good Everton fixtures, and as you said, I think about Dina too. It's like, I don't have Calvert-Lewin, I have Dina at least. Okay,
yeah, I'm same. I think that's kind of the same sort of the balance I've struck. All right, well, we've spoken for a while, but hopefully that was really useful in terms of, you know, giving an idea of how this year's pricing has fallen out.
Thanks very much for listening, guys. I think that pretty much rounds off this show. If you haven't listened to our summer specials, there were three of them posted over the last few weeks. They are all really good. They've all been really well received, and I think you'd really enjoy them if you haven't listened to them already. If you have listened to those, well, you know then that we are Who Got the Assist, and thanks so much for listening. Don't forget to subscribe if you haven't already. We would really appreciate if you could give us a five-star review on whatever app you listen to this podcast on, because that certainly helps us in feeds. And, you know, it's the start of the season. This is when new listeners come on board, and so your five stars does an awful lot for our metrics at this point. The league code, if you want to join our FPL league, is 2IP43T. You can do a partridge-esque tinkle to it and go 2IP43T if you want to remember it, and then go and type it. It's really good to be back. Thanks so much for listening.
Yeah, thanks very much. We'll be back next week for the final preview ahead of game week one. We'll be joined by a familiar face. But in the meantime, hope to see you. Think about the prices ahead of the new season. And we'll speak to you very, very soon. Goodbye.
Oh, it's a goal. Who got the assist? Who got the assist?
Sports Social Podcast Network.